Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, fans of science fiction and fantasy. You've come to the right place if you want to hear a conversation about writing, creativity, and the latest from some of the greatest writers publishing today. I'm Rob Wolf, and I'm honored to be your host because, honestly, this is pretty fun. But before we start, you can help more people join the fun if you'll go to our New Books in Science Fiction and Fantasy Facebook page and click like. And you can also feel free to leave a suggestion or two for authors you'd like to hear interviewed. And I encourage you also to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever great podcasts are available these days. And leave a nice review. That wouldn't hurt either. So now let's get to what we're really here for, which is to speak with an author and pick his brains. And today, those brains belong to Brian Staveley, author of The Emperor's Blades, the first in a planned trilogy. Thanks for taking the time out from doing whatever it is you've been doing up there in Vermont today to speak with me.
Just trying to finish the third book, so it's nice to take a little break.
Wow, the third book. Okay, so maybe we can, after we talk about the first, we can get a little preview of the second and maybe even a hint about the third.
Sure, absolutely. You can tell me what you want to see in the third book.
Oh, good. Oh, can I suggest?
I'm taking suggestions, you know, more monsters, fewer monsters, some pirates, no pirates, you know, whatever it is. That's just lay it on me.
Can a monster be named after me? I think I've always wanted that.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, I mean, you have kind of a bestial last name as it is. So, you know, some kind of the twisted version of a wolf might not be bad.
Yeah, that's good. All right, I'll take that. So let's start with The Emperor's Blades. It's an epic fantasy novel that focuses on the challenges of three royal siblings whose stories really begin following the murder of their father, who's the emperor.
Yep.
And I guess I wanted to talk a little bit about your ambitions here. You know, when you set out to write this, did you know? I mean, it seems so ambitious to me to write a book with such sweeping scope where you're really creating, I mean, you've got religions in here and forms of combat and new histories. And I guess all books create a new world, right?
Sure.
But an epic fantasy, a fantasy world requires, it seems to me, maybe, and we can discuss this, it seems to me to like have a higher bar, like you have to create and invent more. And I just wondered, when you set out, were you like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to create this, or did you start out with perhaps a smaller idea and it slowly grow?
No, it was quite the opposite, actually. I started out with an enormous idea and pared it down. I've read fantasy my whole life, and especially when I was younger, I read it just voraciously. I'd sit down and read a book over the course of a Sunday or something. And until recently, I was teaching high school, and I was teaching ancient world history and comparative religion and philosophy, and those subjects are all just treasure troves for somebody who is interested in fantasy, especially for somebody who's interested in writing fantasy, because I would come across historical characters or battles or political situations or incidents that I thought were exciting or interesting or intriguing. And because I had this love for an interest in fantasy, I would think, oh, you could use that in a fantasy novel. You could twist it a little bit or do this with it. And so for years, I was teaching these courses and just compiling things that I thought would be awesome in a fantasy novel. And when I decided to actually do it, I wanted to put them all in. And so when I pitched the series to Tor, which is my publisher now, I said, well, what about 7 books? I think 7 books is a nice size for a series. And my editor, Marco Palmieri, this was our first phone conversation where I think he was just trying to determine, okay, is this guy sane? Can he really do it? And he was quite taken aback by that. He said, "No, there's no way on earth we're going to give you a 7-book series. We've seen the first book, but you're an unproven quantity. So why don't we shoot for 3?" And I said, because I was just so delighted to be talking to an editor from Tor, I said, 3 sounds great. Yes, absolutely. 3 is probably much better than 7.
Were you thinking, oh, I'm going to pack in my ideas that I was going to put into 7 books, I'll just pack them into 3 and I'll just call them 3 books, but really in my mind, they'll still be the 7.
No, I was, you know, I'd actually sort of sent in a synopsis, a very, very rough synopsis of a 7-book arc. And it was clear that if I was going to cut it to 3, a lot of stuff was going to have to go. And, you know, whole nations and characters and plot lines just got ripped out by the roots. But, you know, at the time, Marco said, look, why don't we do 3 and we'll see how it's going, see how you're feeling, see how we're feeling, see how the readers are feeling. And if you can, you know, and it looks good, but we'll, you know, you can write some more in this world. And that's definitely where we're headed now. But the story that I'm telling will be closed at the end of 3 books. But, you know, the world is a large place. There's always other stories to tell. So, yeah, it got pared down. And honestly, right now I'm working on the 3rd book and I'm so, so grateful. Marco, if you ever listen to this, thank you. Just wrestling 3 into submission feels like a good challenge right now. I can't imagine how it feels to have so many characters and plot threads out there that you could fill 6 books and then have to handle the 7th. That might be a challenge to tackle down the road, but right now 3 feels like plenty.
I hear you. So you pared it down, and so you're holding in abeyance some of these ideas for the possibility of continuing the story in later volumes, or using them for a completely different story?
A different story in the same world, I'd say. I don't want the end of this series to feel, oh, it's kind of done, but oh, maybe that guy is still alive. You know, that irritates me when it's supposed to be the end of the series. I want to feel like the story is over, and so I fully intend to finish this story at the end of the 3rd book, but some people will be dead. Some people will be still alive. Maybe it'll be worth following them. Or I'm also very open to just exploring different corners of the world. And honestly, I think it'll be fun after this 3rd book to write something that wasn't epic, that was a little bit smaller in scope, that was sort of an adventure tale, maybe a little bit leaning more towards swords and sorcery and away from, you know, sort of world begirdling epic stuff. I'd like to try my hand at that for a book or 3. So we'll see. Right now, I try not to think about it. I try just to keep my eyes on the road here with the 3rd volume.
Is it harder, the way I sort of characterized it in the beginning? I mean, you don't have a common language necessarily with the reader to rely on. You're inventing so many, you know, wonderful new things, like the Ketchel Fighting Force,
right,
that uses these
right.
huge birds to fly on. But you know, it's not just that, it's the whole ethos of what this fighting force is and their rules of combat and the way they figure in the context of this universe, this world, which, you know, they're like the fiercest fighters out there.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's definitely anyone writing second world fantasy, writing in an invented world, has an extra burden. You know, if you're writing a crime novel set in New York in 2012, you can talk about, you know, the Upper West Side or Central Park or whatever. And some readers will have been there. Readers who haven't been there will have seen movies, so they have a vague idea about it. And somebody who has somehow never seen any footage of New York can always go look online and just say, oh, yeah, there's New York. That's what it looks like. Whereas if you say, oh, you know, they came over the hill and saw Anur, that means nothing to any reader because you've just invented Anur. You're building it out of whole cloth.
That's the empire. That's the
right. Yeah, that, like Rome, Anur is the name of the central city and the empire itself. So you're faced then as the builder of the world with, you know, a forking path. You can either create institutions and polities and entities in the world that have different names but are basically bear a one-to-one correspondence to things that we recognize. So, you know, the Dothraki in Game of Thrones, people say, well, they're just the Mongols. And I actually don't think that that's right. But they are kind, they are pretty Mongol-like in some ways. And so a reader, as soon as you break that code, you can just sub in the real world thing that you know for the second world thing. And that's great in one way for a reader because it's way easier. You just say, you know, I was describing a novel to my wife the other day and I was saying, well, these guys are just Russian and they're not called Russian. And these guys are, you know, Japanese, but they're not called Japanese. But on the other hand, it seems like if you're going to create a second world fantasy, you can do more than just sub in real world analogs and give them new names. But then that's a lot harder for the author and for the reader, because the reader can't just say, oh, these guys are Vikings or whatever. It's like, well, they're sort of like Vikings, but they have these traditions that aren't at all like that. And they're monotheistic instead, you know. So the more you want to really create your own stuff, the harder you're making it on yourself and the reader. It's always a bit of a trade-off. And you can do both, you know. You can have some things that are a little more recognizable and some things that are less so.
I mean, is one of the challenges also not being too pedantic about it? I mean, you don't want to have these long asides where you're going, oh, and the Ketchel fighting force is this and this and this, and the history is this and this and this. I mean, you have to integrate it in such a way that it's arising naturally from, I suppose, the perspective of the protagonist in that particular scene, but which must be hard, though.
It's, you know, I'll tell you one thing. It's way easier if you have more than one character in the scene. At the beginning of The Emperor's Blades, you have Caden all by himself, kind of running around in the mountains looking for this goat, and then he finds the slaughtered goat, and he can't figure out who slaughtered it. But the challenge of writing those chapters was that he doesn't have anyone to talk to, so you can't see what the monks are like through their interactions, because he's not interacting with anyone, and you can't see what they're like through their speech patterns, because he's not speaking to anyone. And it's also even really hard to show what the main character is like, because no one's looking at him, and he's unlikely to be thinking about himself. He's not probably going to think, Caden was running through the peaks. Caden was 17 and tall. You have to find a way to include all that information.
Exactly.
It's a lot easier if you have a group of people. So, you know, the first Valen chapters, they're on the deck of this ship, and they're trying to figure out who murdered the sailors. And at least there, you can show a half dozen different Ketrol. And so the reader gets an overview of like, oh, that guy's kind of like that, and they're sort of like this, and she's like that. And you can see how they talk and see how they act and see what they do. So you can get a lot of that world building in more organically. It's easier to get it in organically, let's say.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Let me ask you about since you've mentioned Caden and Valen, who are the brothers, they are the princes or the children of the slain emperor.
Sure.
And they also have a sister. Do you say her name, Adair?
I do, yep.
So you have the three of them, and I thought it was an interesting choice because, you know, if you have a story hanging around the activities of three siblings, especially three, you know, royal siblings, I think the most common narrative about that usually involves some kind of rivalry or some kind of betrayal, sibling rivalry. And this story really seems to be very much so about their loyalty to each other, which might even be a little surprising because they haven't spent that much time together. Their childhoods have been very separate, each training or experiencing a very different kind of upbringing. Adair, as the female in this world, staying closer to the father back in the capital. Valen being trained as a Ketrol in this elite fighting force, and then the heir, Caden, with these monks, and, you know, each in their own world, yet each very, apparently, unless there's some, you know, twist that'll happen in a later book, you know, loyal to each other. And I guess I wanted to explore that. I thought it was a really interesting choice.
Yeah, it's a funny story because it's a family story in which none of the family members really know each other very well. You know, both Valen and Caden were sent away at early ages, so they have only childhood memories of Adair. They don't remember their father very well. The mother is barely mentioned in the first book, although she plays a larger role in the second book. Adair, the only real familial relationship in the story is over when it begins, and that's between Adair and her father. They're the only two who are in any kind of proximity, who really know each other. And so it's an odd tale. They all feel as though they're part of this thing, the Malkinian dynasty. They feel as though they're part of something important and good in the world. They believe in the Anurian Empire and its ability to bring peace and prosperity and stability and justice and all of the things that the proponents of empire are always claiming for their empires. But they don't have a very good sense of how the others are going about it. And so, you know, Valen thinks, well, I can do my part by excelling in this military path. And Adair thinks, well, I'm really the only one who has a handle on the actual running of the empire. Caden doesn't really even understand his role for a long time. So they're all trying to do their part for the empire and their family. But what that part is seems different to each of them. And so there, I think the grounds for conflict are there, but it's not the standard conflict, which is I want to be emperor. No, I want to be emperor. No, I want to be emperor. But a more fundamental question, what is it to be empire? What is the best way to run this thing? They're all going to come at that question from different angles.
Okay, that's interesting. That makes a lot of sense because you have set up this where they each have clearly different strengths and skills and training mm-hmm. and experiences.
And it's not, you know, I'm not as interested in stories where it's just, I taught Macbeth for years and I don't like that play. And I don't like it because Macbeth's ambition seems to me just so boring. It's so naked. He and his wife just want power, full stop. It's not even clear what they want to do with the power. Do they want to have fancy dinner parties or, you know, have a bigger castle or what? They just want the title, the power. And that seems to drive both fantasy and some real world historical incidents. But I don't get it. That doesn't resonate with me. So I didn't want any of these siblings really desperate for the power just for its own sake. But whatever conflict they'll experience in books 2 and 3 in particular comes from a difference of opinion over what the empire is and how it ought to run.
Well, you do seem to be exploring different notions, even among the population, of what, you know, mm-hmm. what it means to be a leader. Because another thing that really struck me that I thought was different was that the usual deference you would have expected from the people around, especially the two brothers, mm-hmm. there was none, basically. I mean, here, Caden is the heir, the emperor's son, and these monks basically treat him like dirt, you know? I mean, like, you know, if there was a child welfare authority, they would be called in and, you know, he would be right. taken into protective services.
Yeah.
And the same goes true for the Ketral, or I'm not saying it right. Ketral? Ketral.
I say Ketral, yeah.
Ketral.
But I think it's the prerogative of a fantasy reader to pronounce the words any which way they please. That's what I've done my whole life.
Well, I believe it's more like you going to a foreign country and you want to learn, you want to pronounce it properly. I always want to have the right accent when I go somewhere. So,
right.
So I consider you the tour guide, the official tour guide and the emperor of this empire.
And to your right, we see the Ketral, and to the left, we have Anur. Don't look over there. Antar's light might blind you.
Exactly. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we are predisposed. It's just, you know, there's an apotheosis of sort of suffering and poverty in fantasy novels. So, you know, generally speaking, in the broad tradition, if somebody is raised sort of poor on a hardscrabble farm in a fantasy novel, they'll probably be a good character. And if they're raised, you know, eating off of silver platters and robed in silk, they're probably going to be evil. And I was sort of curious about that. In some ways, I think Adair is a little bit... So Adair plays counter to type in that way. She's definitely the princess who is raised as a princess. But, you know, Caden's upbringing among the monks doesn't really set him up well to be emperor. he's aware of this and a little bit frustrated by it. He can make pots and he can run for a long time, but those skills are for shit when you're trying to govern a massive empire spanning two continents. So,
not to mention, I kept thinking he must have really low self-esteem because they keep criticizing him for every single thing he does. Like, how's he supposed to have any confidence in the decisions he makes?
Yeah. It's, you know, and especially I think that's the setup for book two. He's hardened and he's tough, but is he tough in the way that he needs to be a good emperor? It's hard for me to imagine somebody going from that upbringing to, you know, doing an excellent job at a large scale bureaucracy. He doesn't even really understand how ordinary people think and feel because he's been living among the monks for so long and they have beaten out of themselves their own feelings. So, you know, I've tried to put them, I've tried to give them all major disadvantages, especially in regard to the roles that they're supposed to fulfill. So that it's not going to be, you know, I think it's pretty obvious that Caden, even at the end of book one, there's no real obvious way for him to just return home gilded in glory. Things are going to be tougher for him. They're going to be tougher for all of them.
Right. I mean, not to mention there's a whole story about who betrayed the father and who's their enemy. And I mean, there's that going on.
Absolutely.
But you're saying internally, too.
Yeah.
He is not necessarily, even though in theory, this ascetic life was mm-hmm. training him for, you know, some kind of higher calling, which would be, in his case, being the emperor. And there's a specific skills that he was actually trained for, which is kind of like an important plot point that I won't just say.
Right.
But which makes sense, but it does seem like a very narrow skill. It's like an important one,
yes. Yeah.
But one, as I can see how he might be missing some other important qualities that would make
right.
him, that would be required of a fully shaped, fully formed leader.
Well, and as you know, as you point out, there are reasons that the heirs to the empire are always sent to the Shin monks. It's not just shitty planning on the part of the emperors. There's a reason that it has to happen, which is revealed partway through the book. But because the natural succession is cut short by this plot, Caden is sort of half-baked as a future emperor when he's, you know, when he's forced towards the spotlight more directly. So, if he had another bunch of years, things would be different, but he doesn't. None of them do. You know, they're all sort of thrust forward, unprepared to some extent, and that's, you know, that's where a lot of the conflict comes from.
Right. So it's interesting. I mean, rather than having it be a story about rivalry among the siblings, it's really more an internal. They're sort of rivals with themselves, the best they can be, or, mm-hmm. or the parts of them that, you know, aren't quite prepared for the roles that they have to take on in this world.
I've written, I don't know, maybe I wrote a blog post, but I forget where I talked about this idea, but I think there are sort of three fundamental types of tension that can exist in a book. There's psychological tension, which exists internal to a character. There's social tension, which exists between characters. And then there's environmental tension, which exists between the character or characters and their environment. You know, so for example, if you have, if you're writing a mountaineering story, the psychological tension might be one character's fear of heights. And then the social tension would be that two characters on the expedition hate each other. And then the environmental tension would be that there's, you know, constant avalanches trying to destroy them. And I think the stories I like, at least, combine all three of those. And so, I've tried to set it up so that Caden and Valen and Adair are all facing those things to some degree. And not only that, but those tensions are compounding each other. The psychological struggles that they face are going to make the social struggles that they face more difficult rather than easier.
I want to ask you about some of the mythology. Key to the backstory are these Sestrim, I would say. Is that how you say it?
I said Sestrim, yeah. Sestrim. I get like a K and an S sound in there.
Okay, Kcestrium.
Yeah.
So these are creatures that are both considered very vicious and horrible and the enemies of humans, and they were destroyed by humans in what's initially presented as mythology. But then towards the end, the question is raised, well, did they really exist? And if they really existed, how do we know that they are really gone? And
right.
And so you're sort of exploring, it seems to me, this idea of Well, kind of the stories that we create about our society. Was this religious historical, you know, figure, was he a historical figure as well as a sort of mythical figure? You know, was he real? Was he not? And I just wonder, you know, if you wanted to talk about that a little bit. I mean, I think you play with it. There's another scene, you know, there's the high priest of Anor, you know, who is accused of killing the emperor. And he tries to demonstrate his innocence by showing that he can withstand tremendous heat, and that therefore shows he's protected by the goddess of fire, and he must be innocent. It's a little like the Salem witch trials. That's what it reminded me of.
Are you
going to sink or float?
Yeah.
But the question is raised: is this a hoax? Is he tricking people, or is this something real? And I feel like you play with that a lot. You know, is this real? Is this a myth? Is this historical fact? Is this goddess real? Is it not? And
yeah.
I wonder what you were trying to get at there.
Well, I think the interesting thing about mythology, you can ask questions, you can interrogate a mythology very directly and just say, okay, you know, did these events happen? Did Odin actually hang from the tree and see what he saw? Did Jesus turn the water into wine? You can pick your ancient story and ask whether it's factual. And that's interesting, and you can do that in a fantasy novel too. But I think that the place where the rubber really meets the road, at least for me, is how those stories, whether they're histories or mythologies, that the characters tell each other intersect with the characters themselves. So, for instance, it's, you know, the Malkinians, some of them have these burning irises. Caden has them, Adair has them, their father has them, and you know, the readers will encounter these early on. They literally look as though they're on fire, this sort of ever burning, unconsumed fire that is their irises. And the Malkinians have a story, which is that way back in sort of prehistoric times, the Antara, the goddess of light and fire, you know, came down to earth and mated with a human and bore their progenitors. And so that they are the descendants of the goddess of fire. And that's the story they tell themselves. And that's the story that, by and large, everyone in the empire believes, at least to some extent. And what I think is neat is they don't know if it's true, right? They haven't met Antara, the goddess of fire. They know there's something really strange going on with their eyes, but, you know, the world is filled with strange and wonderful things. So imagine what that does to you as a person. You think, oh, gosh, I have these burning eyes, and I'm told they're from a goddess, but am I descended from a goddess? And that uncertainty is at the very heart of their role in the empire and of the empire itself. And more broadly, questions about the Kestrel, did they really live? Were they related to humans? Were they not related to humans? Those have a very direct bearing, especially as the story gets underway, with the way that some of the characters in the book itself behave. Were the Kestrel evil? That's a pretty fundamental question, especially if you think there might still be some of them around. And so I think you can ask two interest. You can interrogate these mythologies in a couple interesting ways. One is just to try and get to the actual answer, which I always feel rewarded as a reader of fantasy when you get to know a little bit more of the mythology. But the other is to see the way that the quest for that answer, whether it's successful or not, makes the characters who they are. And so that's what I really like to explore in these books. There's uncertainty here, and that's going to change the behavior of the main actors.
Those eyes are very distinctive, and it does make me wonder how people can treat them so matter-of-factly. I mean, it's very interesting that they do, but when you see Caden with those eyes, and yet the monks, you know, still treat him like a regular person, and yet, you know, his eyes are on fire.
Right. And it shows something about the monks, too. Their indifference to that suggests that they might be indifferent to a whole lot of things.
Looping back to what you had spoken of earlier, that in creating a new world, you can draw upon things that are familiar, but make them a little different. And, you know, I couldn't help but think of some kind of Buddhist enlightenment that they were aspiring to when you talk about,
sure,
you know, they're meditating, they're clearing their heads. And is that, was that part of what you pictured in your mind?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, yeah, this does double back on what we were talking about a little bit earlier. The Shin monks they pull heavily from Buddhist tradition, which a lot of people have remarked on, but also Taoist tradition. And a lot of the a lot of the expressions that they have, you know, Caden is always thinking of these aphorisms and little training mantras. Those are inspired even more by the Tao Te Ching and other Taoist texts than they are by stuff in Buddhism. But I'm pulling on both of those traditions, but also trying to turn it one more twist or two more twists, so that there's something about these monks that's actually a little bit darker than both the Buddhist and the Taoist traditions, because what they seem to be trying to do is to turn themselves into something that is not human, or that is only human in a very limited sense. And of course, the Kseestrim were themselves not human. And so I think that unlike the stereotypical image of the Buddhist monk kind of sitting on the cliffside meditating, which doesn't have a whole lot of negative connotations, I think there's something, or there should be something, a little bit unsettling about the Shin monks, Buddhism seen in kind of a darker mirror, or Taoism seen in a darker mirror. So, but that's not to say that I wasn't drawing on those real world analogs in all sorts of ways when I was writing them.
Well, and you know, it's funny you mentioned, or perhaps not funny, but interesting that you mentioned the sort of Taoist aphorisms that you were recreating here, because there's also a lot of aphoristic or citation of, on the war side, the other brother who is learning how to fight. He too, Valen, is drawing on, and I forget the guy's name, but there's some famous warrior whose wisdom is constantly being quoted.
Well, the first chapter of Hendren's Tactics is just one sentence: assume nothing. I have a lot of history written about Hendren, actually, that, you know, this is, when I say that I might write more stories in this world, or that I probably will, you know, this is the kind of thing that my mind goes to. I have a lot of history written about Hendren. And so I have a good sense of who he is, and the kinds of things that he would say. He's, you know, some people say, oh, he's a little bit like Sun Tzu. I think he's more jocular and a little bit, quite a bit more irreverent. And that's, I think, what puts some of his things apart from the Shin sayings, which are pretty serious. There's not a lot of jocularity in the Shin sayings. But I like having a world, and, you know, Adair, more than even Caden and Valen, she is often thinking of texts, you know, usually historical texts or political treatises. And, you know, I'm a reader. Books are a huge part of my world. And I, you know, it would be, I think, a fantasy world in which the fantasy characters also have a relationship with either written text or at least stories and wisdom that is passed down. Just, it's almost a necessity for me.
And do you, I mean, when you say you've written a lot about Hendren, I mean, have you written his book? Do you have all his wisdom written down? Or
No, I haven't. That's a good question. It would be interesting to sit down and write those sort of foundational texts first. But no, I'm still kind of compiling it. And honestly, the way that those sayings come into being is that, you know, Hendren obviously has an uncanny way of saying something that happens to be relevant to Valen at any particular point, right? What Valen remembers is what's relevant. And so that's usually the way they come about. It's Valen will be doing something. And I think this would be a time where he would think back to some kind of where he would need the aid of something from his training. And then, you know, you sit down for a while and whip up some stuff that Hendren might have said.
And so how do you keep the world consistent when you're writing for, you know, such an extended, you're staying in this world, you know, over the course of three very deep books? I mean, do you have like a style sheet or a cheat sheet that's like, you know, I mean, because I think it would be very easy to kind of slip in anachronisms that you don't intend to, or technology or forms of communication, or just language, you know, that isn't entirely consistent. So I just wonder how you, as a writer, keep things straight.
I have a method which is basically madness. It's just hundreds of Word documents. So there's Word documents for each character. There's Word documents for each city. There's Word documents for stuff like, you know, Intara's spear, which is the insanely large tower in the middle of the Dawn Palace. There's a Word document for the Dawn Palace. There's maps of the Dawn Palace. And it's all just sort of there on my computer. And then when I think, oh, shit, I don't remember something about the history of that place, I go back and I look at it. But it is not at all a foolproof method. And it's not unusual for me to find myself thinking, oh, how long was Rampuri Tan with the Shin monks? Have I committed to an answer on that already? And the Emperor's Blades, that needs to be consistent in the second book. And I'll tell you, every time, you know, now two of the books are set in stone. And in a way, it's wonderful because I don't need to edit them anymore. But in a way, it's you're just building the bars of your own prison. And more than once writing this third book, I've thought, oh, I would love to go back and change that one detail because I could set something up for the third book. But you can't. Those first two books are out there. And so you live within the confines of the world that you've created. And that can feel like a curse, but I think it's also a blessing. You know, the world gets more solid with each book, and I think you can flesh it out more instead of always just making up a new thing. So,
and does it, I mean, it's a bit like the real world. We live with the consequences of our actions. You know, we can't go back and change our own personal histories.
Well, I mean, just sometimes it's things that characters have done. You think, oh, you know, gosh, everything that they need to do, that they do from now on, needs to be consistent with that. And sometimes it's just details of the landscape or you know, the geography that you think, oh, it would be way more convenient if this city was a little bit closer to that other city, right? Because then a certain type of plot would work that now is just won't. And there are hundreds of things like that I've been running up against in book three.
So what's the second book called? It's coming out early next year, right?
The second book is coming out in mid-January of this coming year, so a few months from now. It's called The Providence of Fire. And you can see the cover. Tor revealed the cover the day that The Emperor's Blades was released, actually, because we had a working manuscript back then. It is different from The Emperor's Blades. It's 100 pages longer. Adair gets a much expanded role. I think she has the most pages of any of the point of view characters. There's a fourth point of view character, although a relatively minor one. And if The Emperor's Blades involves a lot of mystery, is sort of a mystery novel, especially on Valen's End, and a training novel, and even a little bit of a coming of age story, everybody hits the ground running in Providence of Fire. It's sort of, from the first chapters of all three of the siblings, they are doing something and going somewhere. And so you, as a result, you as the reader get to see a lot more of the world, and the characters do too. You know, in book one, there's Anur, where Adair is, and the Bone Mountains, where Caden is, and the Kieran Islands, where Valen is. In book two, I forget now, I think I counted, but it depends how you count. There are maybe nine different settings, and because they're going places, they're doing things. And so I think that that's exciting, and it feels different from the first book, which is at least geographically somewhat static.
And the thrust is them trying to continue to like unravel the conspiracy against their family and their father, like who really killed their father and who is trying to undermine their world and their leadership.
They are absolutely continuing to try to unravel all that. That's at the heart of the story, but that doesn't take place in a peaceful environment. You know, that the Empire is sort of falling apart as a result of their father's death, and there are a lot of conflicting forces out there. So it's not as though they can all sort of go home and have tea and have a series of peaceful discussions with a private investigator about who killed their dad. You know, even just getting home for Valen and Caden is sort of a fraught question. And for Adair, being home is sort of horrifying given some of the discoveries she makes in book one. So they are trying to sort out that central mystery, but there's a lot more happening that they have to grapple with all at the same time that compounds the difficulty of solving that mystery.
And so book three, you're in the middle of writing, so you're still, it's a little open-ended, so readers can send their suggestions.
Absolutely, yeah. You want somebody to die, you want somebody brought back from the dead, just let me know. Writing the third book, writing a final book, I think is a real challenge. There are so many series and books and movies that I have loved until the end, and then thought, oh, that's what it was? Or, oh, there's just a big explosion? Or, oh, there's just a big fight? And I am desperate not to recreate that feeling in the readers of this series that, oh, okay, it's all just leading up to that. And so I feel like that that little gremlin is just sitting on my shoulder growling into my ear every day. But you know, rest assured, I have some tricks up my sleeve I'm excited about. So it's just a matter of figuring out how to deploy them.
Excellent. Well, something to look forward to. That's wonderful. So people should go out and they should buy The Emperor's Blades right away, because pretty soon there's going to be the second book, and surely not too long after that, the third book. So I hope everyone gets started. So thanks, Brian Stavely, for speaking with me on new books in science fiction and fantasy. I really have enjoyed the discussion.
Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure.
So, as you can hear, we've been talking with Brian Stavely, author of The Emperor's Blades, and I am Rob Wolf, your host. I actually have written a couple books myself, The Alternate Universe and its sequel, The Escape, and so I will take advantage of my platform here to just encourage you to check them out on Amazon. I'll have to say I'm a little embarrassed to be promoting myself. My brother thinks I shouldn't do it. He thinks it's in bad taste. But I guess I don't receive any compensation for hosting this other than the pleasure of speaking with really interesting writers like Brian Stavely and other folks who coming up include the editors of Hieroglyph, Stories and Visions for a Better Future, that I expect to be speaking with them in the coming weeks. So please come back for more. Don't forget to subscribe on iTunes and like us on Facebook and review the show if you've enjoyed it. And thanks so much for listening.